Many of us have a morning routine, a way to ease ourselves into the day ahead. Having a bath or shower, eating breakfast, doing your hair and makeup, getting dressed, listening to the radio, etc. I know that with my routine, I don't even think about it anymore. It's that habitual that I just get up and do it without a second thought, and I'm sure that many of you are the same. When two parents entered their daughter's house one January morning, it was clear that she had also followed her morning routine. They found an unmade bed, a wet towel hanging up, and makeup lying across the bathroom countertop. One thing they couldn't find, however, was their daughter or her vehicle. And while her car has since been found in a place that she had no reason to be, their daughter still remains missing to this day, and her parents continue to fight for answers. Let's uncover the unsolved disappearance of Jennifer Kesey. Hello and welcome to the 55th episode of Uncover True Crime Podcast. My name is Stephanie, and each week we uncover a different unsolved true crime case, ranging from missing persons, unsolved murders, and suspicious deaths. You can listen to the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast streaming apps. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at @uncover_pod, on Instagram at @uncovertruecrimepod, and you can join the Uncover True Crime discussion group on Facebook. But without any further ado, let's uncover the unsolved disappearance of Jennifer Kesey. Jennifer Joyce Kesey was born on the 20th of May 1981 to Drew and Joyce Kesey. 3 years later, the couple welcomed another child into the world, Jennifer's younger brother Logan. The Keseys lived in New Jersey and were an idyllic family. Investigative reporter Louis Bolden described them by saying, quote, "To meet the Keseys is to love the Keseys. They're just good people," unquote. Jennifer and Logan were particularly close, and as they entered adulthood, they became best friends. They were in each other's social circles, and Jennifer would always attend her brother's soccer games, as Logan was big into the sport. After high school, Jennifer attended the University of Central Florida and joined the Alpha Delta Pi sorority. She majored in business administration and graduated in 2003. She then got a job working at a timeshare company and worked as a financial analyst after being promoted twice within the 12 months of her starting there. There was more to Jennifer's life than work, though, as she was very close to her family and was in a long-term relationship with a man she met on a night out called Rob Allen. He lived in Fort Lauderdale, which was 3 hours away from Jennifer's home in Orlando, but they were both very committed to each other. Rob told the media, quote, "You know that feeling when you just don't want to get off the phone because you enjoy talking to the person so much? That's how it was with Jen. 3 and 4 hours would pass and we'd still be talking. We had an incredible relationship. It was long distance, but we made it work. When you find that instant connection with someone, you find a way to make it work," unquote. The weekend before Jennifer's disappearance, the pair had gone on holiday together to the Virgin Islands. Jennifer was so excited when she returned that she told her mum everything that happened on the trip, and Joyce stated that her daughter was very happy. Rob's friends could also tell how happy he was, and while long distance must have taken its toll, they were figuring it out together. Everything in Jennifer's life seemed to be going according to plan. She'd even just bought her own condo in Orlando. It would be at this condo that Jennifer would get up one morning, get ready and leave for work, but would never make it there and was never seen again. On the 23rd of January 2004, Jennifer was in contact with her parents, brother, and her boyfriend. Her family stated that she was fine and there was nothing out of the ordinary, and that never in their wildest dreams did they think that this would be the last time they would talk to her. At 10 p.m. that evening, she called her boyfriend Rob, and he said that the two of them had gotten into an argument. Rob put this down to the fact that they were both tired as they had just returned from the Virgin Islands, and that the long distance was getting to them, both of which are totally understandable, and I don't think it was a big argument by any means, just a typical disagreement between couples. It is then assumed that Jennifer went to bed and got up the next day to go to work, but she didn't arrive. This was very out of character, so her colleagues contacted her parents, who immediately knew something was wrong, so they drove the 2-hour journey from their home to Jennifer's condo. When they arrived at noon, they noticed that her 2004 Chevy Malibu wasn't parked outside, which they also thought was bizarre if she hadn't arrived at work. when they went into her condo, there was no signs of a struggle and no clues as to where she might be. In fact, it looked like she had gotten up that morning and gotten ready for work. Her mother Joyce commented, quote, "There was makeup all over her counter. The t-shirt that she had worn to bed was on the floor. The shower was wet in the corners," unquote. Despite there being no evidence of foul play, Joyce and Rune knew that something had happened to their daughter. They called Rob and her friends to see if they knew anything, but no one had seen her, so they reported her missing. The Orlando police were reluctant to take the report at first, stating that Jennifer probably just wanted some time to herself, following the argument she had had with Rob the night before, and that she would probably turn up in a few hours. The Kesseys knew how committed Jennifer was to her job and knew that she wouldn't just not go in because of a disagreement with her boyfriend, so they started looking for her and were soon joined by her friends, who created posters and plastered them all around her neighbourhood, hoping that someone had seen her. The police started taking her case seriously that evening, and when she hadn't returned home by nightfall, the investigation into her disappearance started. According to media reports, Jennifer's case was very well known in Orlando. You could barely turn a corner in the city without seeing her missing persons poster. Over 1,200 volunteers aided in the search for her, and word soon spread about her disappearance. Orlando police treated Jennifer's case as an abduction from the get-go, but when they arrived at her condo, they didn't seal it off as a crime scene, presumably because there was no signs of foul play. By the time it occurred to the police to do this, 14 or so people had already traipsed in and out, and any forensic evidence probably would have been destroyed or contaminated. They then started to determine when exactly she'd been abducted by examining information gathered by nearby cell towers. This data indicated that her phone had not been in her condo the night before her parents had found that she was missing, and by extension, the police assumed that she had been abducted on the 23rd. Despite the fact that everything in her condo indicated that she had gotten ready for work the morning of the 24th. Police investigated her case under this assumption until they realised that they had quote-unquote misinterpreted the cell phone tower data, which actually showed that her phone had indeed been in her condo that night and hadn't left until the next morning. Although I don't know if they were ever able to determine where her phone had pinged that day, or if it has indeed ever been found. Police then tried to find her car, which was apparently last seen leaving the car park at her condo at 7:40 a.m. on the 24th. The couple who saw the car drive away said that whoever was driving the car was doing so quite erratically, which in hindsight might suggest that Jennifer was struggling for control of the car, or whoever was driving was trying to make a quick getaway. I don't know if the police were able to confirm the sighting of her car, and it was only mentioned in a couple of sources, but it does seem to fit when Jennifer probably would have left to go to work. 3 days later, on the 28th of January, Jennifer's car was discovered less than a mile from her home, in a car park outside the Huntington-on-the-Green apartment complex, which is supposedly a known spot for criminals to dump stolen cars. When the police looked inside the car, they found a DVD player which would have been worth quite a bit of money back in 2006, so police didn't think that Jennifer was the victim of a robbery or a carjacking. No forensic evidence could be gathered from the vehicle, as whoever had left it there had wiped it clean first. Jennifer's prints weren't even found on the steering wheel, which you would expect given that it was her car. Police thought that they might be able to catch a break since there was CCTV cameras in the car park where her car was found. Detectives got hold of the footage, and when they examined it, they realised it was going to be of very little use to them. The camera was of very poor quality, bearing in mind that this was 2006, and it didn't film video footage. Instead, it captured a black and white still image every 3 seconds. Images obtained from the camera did show someone parking the Chevy Malibu in the car park on the 24th. Although it is unclear what time. They stayed in the car for around 30 seconds, presumably to wipe the steering wheel and handles to avoid leaving any evidence behind. They then got out of the car and left the car park. Now, this is the frustrating part. Whoever dumped Jennifer's car is one lucky son of a bitch, because in all the still images taken of them walking away, their face is hidden behind fence posts that surrounded the car park. Police can't even tell if it is a man or a woman. The only information they were able to obtain from the images is that the person was probably between 5 foot 3 inches tall and 5 foot 5 inches tall, and that they were wearing clothes similar to that of a manual labourer or a painter. The images are available online, and to be honest, I think it is even hard to tell what kind of clothes they are wearing. I am no expert, but all I can tell is they are wearing all white, and while they might be wearing dungarees like a labourer or a painter, you can't tell this for certain. One thing I noticed, which I haven't seen many people mention, is that I think it kinda looks like the person is wearing a hat of some kind. Personally, I think it looks like a flat cap, or as we call it in Scotland, a bonnet, but this is just a personal observation. Another thing I noticed is that they seem to have very short hair, indicating that it might be a male, but their height could suggest that it is a woman. I know that women can have very short hair, men can also be quite short. These are just generalisations. My point is that you can't tell much from these images at all, which is a shame because if this person wasn't so damn lucky, it might have been a better lead for the police to go off of. Depending on what source you read, the person in the images is being treated as a suspect or person of interest in Jennifer's disappearance, but they remain unidentified as it is virtually impossible to ID someone from these images. After years of there being no progress in their daughter's case, Drew and Joyce Casey sued the Orlando Police Department in order to get their hands on Jennifer's case file. Police are usually very reluctant to give this information over to the families of missing persons, often citing that it is an ongoing investigation and that releasing this information to them could hurt the case. However, in a very unusual move, the OPD police chief Orlando Rowland gave the Casseys their daughter's case file, which contained over 16,000 pages and 67 hours of audio and video clips. Chief Rowland was very sympathetic to the Casseys, saying, quote, "I can understand why they're frustrated. I can understand why they would feel that maybe an agency like ours hasn't delivered on what they would expect an agency to do. After the number of years that we have spent trying to solve Jennifer's disappearance, I think it is time to also honour the wishes of the family. The family wants closure. We want closure. We want to find the person responsible for her disappearance. I think it's a win-win for all." Unquote. The Casseys then hired a private investigator called Michael Toretta, who I believe works on this case full time. After going through the case file, there was one tip in particular that stood out to him. He said that the day that Jennifer went missing, someone was observed dumping a piece of rolled up carpet into a lake near Jennifer's home. At this exact same time, workers at the complex where she lived were laying carpet across from her condo, so Michael knew he had to follow up on this tip. From Google Maps, I was able to see that there are several small bodies of water near the Mosaic apartment complex where Jennifer lived. However, none of them lead to any bigger lakes or rivers, so I can't imagine that this piece of carpet and whatever was rolled up in it would be that hard to find. However, in November 2019, divers did search the lake where the person was seen dumping the carpet and found nothing. Michael Toretta still seems convinced by this tip though, saying, quote, "There is something that's haunting me. Until we find that carpet and see what's in it, we need to follow up on that particular lead." Unquote. No other leads in Jennifer's case have been revealed publicly, so we are left with our theories, which, like all theories we discuss in this podcast, are just pure speculation. The first theory centres around one of the workers at Jennifer's apartment complex. A woman who used to work at a housekeeper there was interviewed 3 years after Jennifer went missing, and she stated that the person in the images from the CCTV looked like a manual labourer from the complex called Chino. She stated that she thought this because of his hair and the way he walked. Although I don't really understand this, as only still images are available of this person, so I don't know how you could determine someone's gait from that. An anonymous tip was called into the police shortly after Jennifer went missing, which also implicated Chino as being a suspect in her case, but no further information about this tip has been revealed publicly. Police did follow up with Chino, who was said to be very cooperative, and while he admitted to having heard about Jennifer's case and to working in her condo just a week before she went missing, he denied knowing what happened to her. Like many of the workers who were doing construction within the complex, Chino lived in one of the empty condos, but apparently moved out in the middle of the night 9 months after Jennifer was last seen. Personally, I don't think that proves anything, because why would you wait that long to move out if you were involved? He also passed a polygraph test, which, as regular listeners will know, I don't think proves anything either. One thing that does seem to rule him out though is that Chino is 5'9", which is significantly taller than the person in the CCTV footage. And while there probably is some margin for error, this does seem to be quite a big height difference for it to be him. Even if Chino wasn't involved in her disappearance, it is possible that one of the other construction workers was. Jennifer's friends and family knew that she felt quite uneasy in the complex that she lived in, because she had a bad feeling about some of the construction workers who were working there at the time. The complex was still under construction when Jennifer moved in, and she was one of the only residents who had actually moved into the complex, so there were several empty condos, which many of the workers had moved into, as I've previously mentioned. This made Jennifer feel quite unsafe, and according to her best friend Lauren McCarthy, one of the biggest reasons this complex appealed to her so much was because it was within a gated community. Jennifer was very safety conscious, perhaps due to the fact that her parents had once been held at gunpoint and robbed, or maybe it was the fact that she was a young woman living by herself. However, everyone in her life knew this about her. I don't know if something had happened to make her feel this way about the construction workers, or if it was just a bad feeling she had, but she wasn't the only person living in the complex who felt this way. Colleen, another woman who lived in the complex, told the media, quote, "When I would come home from work, there would be a large group of men drinking outside. And whenever I would have to walk past them, you know, there would be a bit of comments or just a lot of uncomfortable stares. It wasn't a great feeling. I didn't like it," unquote. She also stated that she had complained about this to the office manager, but that he had said there was not a lot that he could do. Another resident called Tammy had a slightly more sinister experience, saying, quote, "From the very beginning, there were some uneasy things that I kind of brushed off that were red flags. There were creepy things, like my underwear drawer would be tossed. One time the shower was wet. There was footprints in my closet," unquote. She also said that she had caught a man who she believed to be one of the construction workers masturbating on her patio. When he had seen that he had been caught, he fled in a white van and Tammy filed a police report, although the man was never caught. This is all the information we know about the construction workers, and to my knowledge, none of them have ever been named as a person of interest or a suspect. Obviously, in cases like Jennifer's, police will look to those closest to the victim, such as her boyfriend Rob Allen. As we know, they did have an argument the night before she is thought to have been abducted. Is it possible that he wanted to smooth things over with her, so drove down in the morning to talk to her, but things got out of hand? Well, police have been able to rule him out, as he lived 3 hours away from Jennifer and has an alibi for that day, meaning it's impossible that he would have had the time to travel to Orlando, hurt Jennifer, dispose of her body, then drive back home. Other than the unknown individual in the CCTV footage, no other person of interest or suspect has been named in her case, and no one knows of anyone who would want to hurt her. Did Jennifer have a stalker? Was this a crime of opportunity committed by a total stranger? Or was her gut feeling about the construction workers right all along? One thing that most people who have looked into this case agree upon is that Jennifer was likely kidnapped when she went to get into her car on the 24th of February 2006. The person likely bundled Jennifer into her own car and took off. But why they did this and where they took her still remains a mystery. In 2016, 10 years after she went missing, Drew and Joyce Casey had Jennifer declared legally dead, but they are still working hard to find her so they can bring her home and get her justice. Joyce Casey told the media, quote, "It's very, very hard to move forward. The hole in our heart is forever there until we have an answer," unquote. Rob Allen still thinks about Jennifer all the time and about the life they could have had if she hadn't disappeared. Quote, "I just think about her all the time. Who knows what would have happened if this heinous crime hadn't been committed," unquote. Not only have the Kesseys worked hard on their daughter's case, but they have also set up a scholarship at Jenny's alma mater called the Jennifer Kessey Criminal Justice Endowed Scholarship Fund, which is awarded to one postgraduate student a year who is planning a career in law enforcement. According to Jennifer's father, they created the scholarship to try and ensure that the most suitable people would be given the best possible chance to start their career in law enforcement. Quote, "We have learned that the first responders are the most important people in any crime. We want to turn out the best possible law enforcement officers who are first responders." Unquote. I'm now going to give you a description of Jennifer Kessey. She was last seen on the 23rd of January 2006, but is thought to have been kidnapped the following day on the 24th. She was 24 years old at the time, and if alive today, she would be 40. She was a white female, around 5'8" tall, and weighed 125 pounds. She had long blonde hair, dark eyebrows, a cleft chin, green eyes, but apparently did sometimes appear to be blue. It is unknown what she was wearing when she was abducted, but she might have had on a 3-stone diamond necklace. She wore contact lenses, and on her left hand she had several skin tags and a birthmark on her middle finger. She had another strawberry blonde birthmark on her ribs. She had a shamrock tattoo on her left hip, and scars inside of her left elbow. Crimeline are currently offering a $15,000 reward for information that leads to an arrest in her case. If you have any information on Jennifer's disappearance or her whereabouts, you can call Crimeline on 1-800-423-TIPS, which is 8477. Alternatively, you can call the Federal Bureau of Investigation on 407-875-9976 and quote the case number 06-32039. That is everything I have for you today. Thank you for listening till the very end. Please stay safe and have a good night.